offensive gestures. I didn't ask her yet again about her possible text. Whatever she said, I was certain that it wouldn't reassure me. I didn't know how to get out of this depression, what to hold on to. The problem was no longer Leela's work, or its quality, or at least I didn't need to be aware of that threat to feel that everything I had written since the end of the 60s had lost weight and force, no longer spoke to an audience as it seemed to me it had done for decades, had no readers. Rather, on that melancholy occasion of death, I realized that the very nature of my anguish had changed. Now I was distressed that nothing of me would endure through time. My books had come out quickly, and with their minor success had for decades given me the illusion of being engaged in meaningful work. But suddenly the illusion faded. I could no longer believe in the importance of my work. On the other hand, for Leela too, everything had passed by. She led an obscure life. Shut up in her parents' small apartment, she filled the computer with impressions and thoughts. And yet, I imagined, there was the possibility that her name, whether it was just a ribbon or not, now that she was an old woman, or even after her death, would be bound to a single work of great significance. Not the thousands of pages that I had written, but a book whose success she would never enjoy. As I instead had done with mine, yet that nevertheless would endure through time and would be read and reread for hundreds of years. Leela had that possibility. I had squandered it. My fate was no different from Giliola's. Hers might be. 51. For a while, I let myself go. I did very little work, but then again, neither the publisher nor anyone else asked me to work more. I saw no one. I only made long phone calls to my daughters, insisting that they put the children on, and I spoke to them in baby talk. Now, Elsa, too, had a boy named Conrad, and Dede had given Hamid a sister, whom she had called Elena. Those childish voices which expressed themselves with such precision made me think of Tina again. In the moments of greatest darkness, I was sure that Leela had written the detailed story of her daughter, sure that she had mixed it into the history of Naples with the arrogant naivete of the uneducated person who, perhaps for that very reason, obtains tremendous results. Then I understood that it was a fantasy of mine. Without wanting to, I was adding apprehension to envy, bitterness, and affection. Leela didn't have that type of ambition. She had never had ambitions. To carry out any project to which you attach your own name, you have to love yourself. And she had told me she didn't love herself. She loved nothing about herself. On the evenings of greatest depression, I went so far as to imagine that she had lost her daughter in order not to see herself reproduced in all her antipathy, in all her malicious reactivity, in all her intelligence without purpose. She wanted to eliminate herself, cancel all the traces, because she couldn't tolerate herself. She had done it continuously for her entire existence, ever since she had shut herself off within a suffocating perimeter, confining herself at a time when the planet wanted to eliminate borders. She had never gotten on a train, not even to go to Rome. She had never taken a plane. Her experience was extremely limited, and when I thought about it, I felt sorry for her. I laughed. I got up with a groan. I went to the computer. I wrote yet another email saying, "Come and see me. We'll be together for a while." At those moments, I took it for granted that there was not and never would be a manuscript of Leela's. I had always overestimated her. Nothing memorable would emerge from her. something that reassured me and yet truly upset me. I loved Leela. I wanted her to last, but I wanted it to be I who made her last. I thought it was my task. I was convinced that she herself, as a girl, had assigned it to me. 52. The story that I later called A Friendship originated in that mildly depressive state in Naples during a week of rain. Of course, I knew that I was violating an unwritten agreement between Leela and me. I also knew that she wouldn't tolerate it. But I thought that if the result was good, in the end she would say, "I'm grateful to you. These were things I didn't have the courage to say even to myself, and you said them in my name." There is this presumption in those who feel destined for art and above all literature. We act as if we had received an investiture, but in fact, no one has ever invested us with anything. It is we who have authorized ourselves to be authors, and yet we are resentful if others say, "This little thing you did doesn't interest me. In fact, it bores me. Who gave you the right?" Within a few days, I wrote a story that over the years, hoping and fearing that Leela was writing it, I had imagined in every detail. I did it because everything that came from her, or that I ascribed to her, had seemed to me, since we were children, more meaningful, more promising than what came from me. When I finished the first draft, I was in a hotel room with a balcony that had a beautiful view of Vesuvius and the gray semicircle of the city. I could have called Leela on the cell phone, said to her, "I've written about me, about you, about Tina, about Ima. Do you want to read it? It's only 80 pages. I'll come by your house. I'll read it aloud." I didn't do that out of fear. She had explicitly forbidden me not only to write about her, but also to use persons and episodes of the neighborhood. When I had, she always found a way of telling me, even if painfully, that the book was bad, that either one is capable of telling things just as they happened, in teeming chaos, or one works from imagination, inventing a thread, and I had been able to do neither the first thing nor the second. So I let it go. I calmed myself, saying, "It will happen as it always does. She won't like the story. She'll pretend it doesn't matter. In a few years, she'll make it known to me, or tell me clearly that I have to try to achieve more." In truth, I thought, if it were up to her, I would never publish a line. The book came out. I was swept up by a success I hadn't felt for a long time, and since I needed it, I was happy. A Friendship kept me from joining the list of writers whom everyone considers dead, even when they're still alive. The old books began to sell again. Interest in me was rekindled. In spite of approaching old age, life became full again. But that book, which at first I considered the best I had written, I later did not love. It's Leela who made me hate it, by refusing in every possible way to see me, to discuss it with me, even to insult me and hit me. I called her constantly. I wrote endless emails. I went to the neighborhood. I talked to Reno. She was never there. And on the other hand, her son never said, "My mother is acting like this because she doesn't want to see you." As usual, he was vague. He stammered, "You know how she is. She's always out. She either turns off the cell phone or forgets it at home. Sometimes she doesn't even come home to sleep." So I had to acknowledge that our friendship was over. 53. In fact, I don't know what offended her, a detail or the whole story. A Friendship had the quality, in my opinion, of being linear. It told concisely, with the necessary disguises, the story of our lives, from the loss of the dolls to the loss of Tina. Where had I gone wrong? I thought for a long time that she was angry because, in the final part, although resorting to imagination more than at other points of the story, I related what, in fact, had happened in reality. Leela had given Ima more importance in Nino's eyes. In doing so, had been distracted and, as a result, lost Tina. But evidently what in the fiction of this story serves in all innocence to reach the heart of the reader becomes an abomination for one who feels the echo of the facts she has really lived. In other words, I thought for a long time that what had assured the book's success was also what had hurt Leela most. Later, however, I changed my mind. I'm convinced that the reason for her repudiation lay elsewhere, in the way I recounted the episode of the dolls. I had deliberately exaggerated the moment when they disappeared into the darkness of the cellar. I had accentuated the trauma of the loss, and to intensify the emotional effects, I had used the fact that one of the dolls and the lost child had the same name. The whole led the reader, step by step, to connect the childhood loss of the pretend daughters to the adult loss of the real daughter. Leela must have found it cynical, dishonest, that I had resorted to an important moment of our childhood, to her child, to her sorrow, to satisfy my audience. But I am merely piecing together hypotheses. I would have to confront her, hear her protests, explain myself. Sometimes I feel guilty, and I understand her. Sometimes I hate her for this decision to cut me off so sharply right now, in old age, when we are in need of closeness and solidarity. She has always acted like that. When I don't submit, see how she excludes me, punishes me, ruins even my pleasure in having written a good book. I'm exasperated. Even this staging of her own disappearance, besides worrying me, irritates me. Maybe little Tina has nothing to do with it. Maybe not even her ghost, which continues to obsess Leela, both in the more enduring form of the child of nearly four, and in the labile form of the woman who today, like Ima, would be 30. It's only and always the two of us who are involved. She, who wants me to give what her nature and circumstances kept her from giving. I, who can't give what she demands. She, who gets angry at my inadequacy and out of spite wants to reduce me to nothing, as she has done with herself. I, who have written for months and months and months to give her a form whose boundaries won't dissolve and defeat her. And calm her, and so, in turn, calm myself. Epilogue. Restitution. 1. I can't believe it myself. I've finished this story that I thought would never end. I finished it, and patiently reread it, not so much to improve the quality of the writing, as to find out if there are even a few lines where it's possible to trace the evidence that Leela entered my text and decided to contribute to writing it. But I have had to acknowledge that all these pages are mine alone. What Leela often threatened to do, enter my computer, she hasn't done. Maybe she wasn't even capable of doing. It was long a fantasy I had as an old woman inexperienced in networks, cables, connections, electronic spirits. Leela is not in these words. There is only what I've been able to put down. Unless, by imagining what she would write and how, I am no longer able to distinguish what's mine and what's hers. Often, during this work, I telephoned Reno. I asked about his mother. He doesn't know anything. The police limited themselves to summoning him 3 or 4 times to show him the bodies of nameless old women. So many of them disappear. A couple of times I had to go to Naples, and I met him in the old apartment in the neighborhood, a space darker, more run down than it had been. There really wasn't anything of Leela anymore. Everything that had been hers was gone. As for the son, he seemed more distracted than usual, as if his mother had definitively gone out of his head. I returned to the city for 2 funerals, first my father's, then Lydia's, Nino's mother. I missed the funeral of Donato, not out of bitterness, only because I was abroad. When I came to the neighborhood for my father, there was a great uproar because a young man had just been murdered at the entrance to the library. That made me think that this story would continue forever, recounting now the efforts of children without privileges to improve themselves by getting books from the old shelves, as Leela and I had done as girls. And now, the thread of seductive chatter, promises, deceptions, of blood that prevents any true improvement in my city or in the world. The day of Lydia's funeral was overcast. The city seemed tranquil. I felt tranquil, too. Then Nino arrived, and all he did was talk loudly, joke, even laugh, as if we were not at his mother's funeral. I found him large, bloated, a big, ruddy man with thinning hair who was constantly celebrating himself. Getting rid of him after the funeral was difficult. I didn't want to listen to him, or even look at him. He gave me an impression of wasted time, of useless labor, that I feared would stay in my mind, extending into me, into everything. On the occasion of both funerals, I made plans ahead of time to visit Pasquale. In those years, I did that whenever I could. In prison, he had studied a lot, had received his high school diploma, and, recently, a degree in astronomical geography. If I'd known that to get a diploma and a degree, all you needed to have was free time, to be shut up in a place without worrying about earning a living, and, with discipline, learning by heart pages and pages of some books, I would have done it before, he said once, in a teasing tone. Today, he's an old man. He speaks serenely. He is much better preserved than Nino. With me, he rarely resorts to dialect. But he hasn't moved even a hair's breadth out of the space of generous ideas in which his father enclosed him as a boy. When I saw him after Lydia's funeral and told him about Leela, he burst out laughing. She must be doing her intelligent and imaginative things somewhere, he muttered. And it moved him to remember the time in the neighborhood library when the teacher assigned prizes to the most diligent readers. And the most diligent was Leela, who took out books illegally with her relatives' cards. Ah, Leela the shoemaker. Leela, who imitated Kennedy's wife. Leela the artist and designer. Leela the worker. Leela the programmer. Leela, always in the same place, and always out of place. Who took Tina from her? I asked.
The Saladas.
Sure. He smiled, showing his bad teeth. I understood that he wasn't telling the truth. Maybe he didn't know it, and it didn't even interest him, but was proclaiming the unshakable faith based on the primary experience of injustice, the experience of the neighborhood that, in spite of the reading he had done, the degree he had taken, the clandestine journeys, the crimes he had committed or been accused of, remained the currency of every certainty he had. He answered,
"Do you also want me to tell you who murdered those two pieces of shit?"
Suddenly, I read in his gaze something that horrified me, an inextinguishable rancor, and I said no.
He shook his head and continued to smile.
He said,
"You'll see that when Leela decides to. She'll show up." But there was not a trace of her.
On those two occasions for mourning, I walked through the neighborhood. I asked around out of curiosity. No one remembered her, or maybe they were pretending. I couldn't even talk about her with Carmen. Roberto died. She left the gas pump, went to live with one of her sons in Formia. What is the point of all these pages, then? I intended to capture her, to have her beside me again. And I will die without knowing if I succeeded. Sometimes I wonder where she vanished, at the bottom of the sea, through a fissure, or down some subterranean tunnel whose existence she alone knows, in an old bathtub filled with a powerful acid, in an ancient garbage pit, one of those she devoted so many words to, in the crypt of an abandoned church in the mountains, in one of the many dimensions that we don't know yet, but Leela does, and now she's there with her daughter. Will she return? Will they return together? Leela old, Tina a grown woman? This morning, sitting on the balcony that looks out over the Po, I'm waiting. 2. I have breakfast every day at 7. I go to the newsstand with the Labrador I got recently. I spend a good part of the morning in the Valentino playing with the dog, leafing through the papers. Yesterday, when I got back, I found on top of my mailbox a package roughly wrapped in newspaper. I took it, perplexed. Nothing indicated that it had been left for me or for any other tenant. There was no note with it, and it didn't even have my last name written in pen somewhere. I cautiously opened one edge of the wrapping, and that was enough. Tina and New leaped out of memory even before I got them completely out of the newspaper. I immediately recognized the dolls that one after the other, almost 6 decades earlier, had been thrown, mine by Leela, Leela's by me, into a cellar in the neighborhood. They were the dolls we had never found, although we had descended underground to look for them. They were the ones that Leela had pushed me to go and retrieve from the house of Don Achille, ogre and thief, and Don Achille had claimed that he hadn't taken them, and maybe he had imagined that it was his son Alfonso who stole them, and so had compensated us with money to buy new ones. But we hadn't bought dolls with that money. How could we have replaced Tina and New? Instead, we bought Little Women, the novel that had led Leela to write The Blue Fairy, and me to become what I was today, the author of many books and, most important, of a remarkably successful story entitled A Friendship. The lobby of the building was silent. No voices or other sounds came from the apartments. I looked around anxiously. I wanted Leela to emerge from stairway A or B, or from the deserted porter's room. Thin, gray, her back bent. I wished it more than any other thing. I wished it more than an unexpected visit from my daughters with their children. I expected that she would say, in her usual mocking way, "Do you like this gift?" But it didn't happen, and I burst into tears. Here's what she had done. She had deceived me. She had dragged me wherever she wanted from the beginning of our friendship. All our lives, she had told a story of redemption that was hers, using my living body and my existence. Or maybe not. Maybe those two dolls that had crossed more than half a century and had come all the way to Turin meant only that she was well and loved me, that she had broken her confines and finally intended to travel the world, by now no less small than hers, living in old age, according to a new truth, the life that in youth had been forbidden to her and that she had forbidden herself. I went up in the elevator. I shut myself in my apartment. I examined the two dolls carefully. I smelled the odor of mold. I arranged them against the spines of my books. Seeing how cheap and ugly they were, I felt confused. Unlike stories, real life, when it has passed, inclines toward obscurity, not clarity. I thought, now that Leela has let herself be seen so plainly, I must resign myself to not seeing her anymore. This concludes the reading of The Story of the Lost Child by Elena Ferrante. Copyright 2015 by Edizione E.O. Translation copyright 2015 by Europa Editions. This book was read by Hilary Huber. This unabridged recording was published by arrangement with Europa Editions and was produced in 2015 by Blackstone Audio, Inc., which holds the copyright. Neither this recording nor any portion of it may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authorization from Blackstone Audio, Inc. If you would like to obtain a monthly update telling you about new releases, call 1-800-SAY-BOOK. That's 1-800-729-2665. For a complete listing of our titles, visit our website at www.downpour.com. Thank you.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.